Morning, Kev. Proceed.
May it please the court. My name is McCord Wilson. I'm here representing the petitioner Summit Contractors, Inc., and we're here today to talk about the OSHA's multi-employer citation policy, or the MEP as we call it throughout our briefs. Your Honor, I have a presentation prepared to discuss all the issues in our brief, but we don't have much time here today. So if the court has questions that they would like to direct me on, I'd be happy to try to do my best to answer those questions. And if there are none, I'll go ahead and start into my presentation. Hearing no questions at the beginning, I want to start by addressing creating employer liability. The Secretary, throughout her brief, argues we don't even need to go into controlling employer liability here because, in this instance, Summit ordered the spider box in question and the spider box did not have GFCI. Therefore, they're clearly the creating employer and we don't need to reach any of the other issues. The problem with that is that the Secretary's prior interpretations under this very standard show that Summit cannot be a creating employer. On February 7th, 2005 and March 3rd, 2005.
I just ask so that I understand how this fits into your argument. Your blue brief lists three arguments. One is that the MEP must be formally promulgated as a rule. I take it what you're about to say is not about that.
Not directly.
The second is that the MEP violates Section 4B4. It's not about that. So is it about the third, about the finding of the element of knowledge?
It's actually relevant to all three because the defense that the Secretary alleges to all three citations or three issues is that under the MEP, we don't need to worry about whether it needed to be go through rulemaking because the controlling employer issue is not reached since the standards clearly authorize creating employer liability. And so what I'm trying to show is that creating employer liability is not an avenue that's open.
Is this an argument you make in your brief?
We certainly argue that we're not the creating employer throughout our brief.
Judge Garland just went over the three issues you raise in the brief. Now, you understand that we're limited to those issues.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, now, do you make the argument in your brief that you're making now?
Yes, Your Honor. We argue in our brief.
Where would I find that in your brief?
It's in our responsive brief in response to the Secretary.
No. Tell me where in your brief it is.
In our principal brief, I know it's there, but I can't point you to it. We argue that rulemaking is required. If Your Honors would like, I will go directly into the rulemaking argument, since that is certainly the most important argument that we raise.
Okay.
From a rulemaking standpoint, Your Honor, we argue that the MEP is a substantive rule that should have been promulgated pursuant to notice and comment rulemaking. The Secretary, on the other hand, argues that it's a general statement of policy that does not require rulemaking. I think that the case law in this commission, in this circuit under Chamber of Commerce, American Bus, Pickus, and numerous other cases show that this MEP, as it's stated, certainly falls into the substantive category.
I'm having trouble understanding why it matters at all. The OSHRC decision and the ALJ opinion and the citation leave out the citation for a moment. Both of those rely on prior adjudications, the position of OSHA in prior adjudications. They do not rely on the MEP. In fact, OSHRC says we're not relying on the MEP, we're relying on prior adjudications. So why does it make any difference what the MEP is?
Well, if we're going under prior adjudications in this circuit, then...
No, we're going to the position of OSHA as it argued in prior adjudications. And in the Martin case, the Supreme Court said that's perfectly fine, and we have repeatedly said that an agency can make its view of a regulation or statute clear in a prior adjudication, doesn't have to do it through rulemaking. Why does it matter what the MEP is?
Well, Your Honor, I think the analysis under that argument is the same as it is under rulemaking, and we've cited to a number of cases that have held that although adjudication is available to the Secretary in some instances, adjudication is not the proper way to bring a substantive rule. And in fact, the Supreme Court has held that we have never authorized the establishment of a substantive rule through adjudication.
What do you mean by a substantive rule?
Well, by a substantive rule, I mean one that affects the rights and duties and obligations of the person that it governs, one that does not entirely leave the decision maker free to exercise its own discretion.
You can't apply a general standard by adjudication, is that what you're saying?
Not if it's a substantive rule, Your Honor. I'm not
clear on what substantive rule means. If the agency adopts a policy and pursues it through adjudication and applies it to a party and says from now on we're going to continue to apply it to a party, is that you regard that as something they can't do?
As long as that rule that they're applying is substantive, and as this circuit has stated, a substantive rule is one that has a substantial impact on an employer by putting a stamp of agency approval or disapproval on a given type of behavior.
What case of ours has ever held that an agency can't proceed in adjudication?
I'm not aware of a particular case that has held that, although in dicta, this court has stated.
Is there a Supreme Court case that has held that?
Yes, Your Honor.
Which one is in your brief?
It's in our reply brief, and it's the Supreme Court in Wyman-Gordon. And the Wyman-Gordon case says that the Supreme Court has never sanctioned rulemaking by adjudication. Rulemaking.
You understand what they meant? You know, there's a generation of administrative law on this question, and this court has explained the difference between Wyman-Gordon, which was a bunch of plurality opinions, and the following case in Bell Aerospace, as the difference between whether an agency can decide a new rule in an adjudication that doesn't apply to that adjudication. That's what the court meant in Wyman-Gordon. And that's not what happened here. Here the agency applies its rule, its policy, to the adjudication and forward. And it's been doing that for many, many years with respect to the multi-employer policy.
That's correct. It has. Again, as I've stated in a brief, I'm not sure I have a better answer for you, but I also would note that the D.C. Circuit has not adopted the MEP. The Fifth Circuit has certainly not adopted the MEP.
I'll just say again, the OSHRC here didn't adopt the MEP. They said we're ruling based on the precedents and adjudications and the position of the Secretary in previous cases.
And I think that if that's the case here, if the MEP is not an issue, if none of the duties and rights that Summit is being held to arise from the MEP, then where is the authority for the citation?
The authority is the OSHA's interpretation of its regulations, statutes, in a host of preceding cases, the Brennan case, the previous Summit case, all of which permit it to go forward without a rule.
I would argue that the IBP case in this circuit does not permit you to go forward under the circumstances in this case. IBP court held that you do not have to conduct safety inspections of subcontractors, while the MEP held you that you do, and we're being held liable for not doing that. The IBP case says that the most you can be expected to do as a general contractor is notify a subcontractor that it's committed violations, but you do
that's
not.
That's if the subcontractor is committing the violation, right?
Yes.
Here, the allegation is that the general committed the violation.
And that's the thing.
That's not really factually opposite, is it?
That's what I was going to address at the very beginning to show that we could not have created this violation under this standard.
You did create the condition.
Your Honor, under this?
You did. I mean, your company, your client, ordered the machine out there. It didn't have the ground fault interruption device on it.
Your Honor,
Who do you think created it?
There are two ways to comply with the requirements of the standard. One is to have a ground fault circuit interrupter, but the other is to have an assured grounding program. And the OSHA
didn't have an assured grounding program.
Well, there's no evidence that we knew whether or not they did, that the subcontractor did. Now the
whose job site was?
I'm sorry.
Whose job site was?
It was Summit's job site.
Yeah. So if there had been an assured grounding program, you would have known, right? Nobody's going to sneak in and put one in without you knowing it, are they, Counsel?
Well, Your Honor, there is no evidence that we go and check and see whether our subcontractors have an assured grounding program. And the preamble to this very standard says that
What's an assured grounding program look like?
Your Honor, it can take any number of appearances, but it just means that they're going to have a program that assures that whatever power they use is properly grounded.
Mm-hmm. And this time they were using your spider box, right?
They were using a spider box that we ordered, yes, sir. Mm-hmm. Your Honor,
there's no assured grounding program in this evidence.
I don't know whether or not
there's none in this evidence, right?
That's true.
Right. Okay.
And there's
so
no.
That's really not in this case, right?
Your Honor, I think it is. And if
there were one out there, you think you would have gone through this whole administrative process and not had it in the record?
Your Honor, I'm not sure. I don't know how to answer
I'm
that.
I'm fairly
question.
Certain. I think you're a better lawyer than that. If there were one there, it'd be in the record.
But, Your Honor, what I'm saying is that under OSHA, the Secretary's interpretations of the standard, we could have installed temporary power that didn't have GFCI, knowing that the subcontractor was going to use it, and we still wouldn't be liable as the creating employer.
Where's that argument made in your blue brief?
We reference interpretive letters of February 7th and March
3rd. You have to make an argument in your brief to win on it. And we don't take one up that's raised for the first time at oral argument or even in reply brief, ordinarily.
But, Your Honor, that was in reply to the Secretary's argument that we created the hazard.
But you knew that argument. That's what OSHRC held, right?
That's right.
And you disagree with that.
I disagree with what?
With OSHRC's holding.
Yes.
Okay, so I'm just asking you, just so I can find it, where in the blue brief did you make the argument you're making now?
We make the argument that we are not the creating employer, but we do not cite to the OSHA's interpretive letters.
And you don't cite to the absence of the grounding program or anything like that?
I believe we state what the standard is, but we don't cite to that, no. But that is part of the Secretary's burden of proof, no matter what. They have the burden of proving violation of the standard.
You're past the burden of proof stage now. You have the burden of establishing error. And you have to do it with an argument that's raised in your brief.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. Go ahead.
Your Honor, I've saved 3 minutes for rebuttal, and I'm at that stage. If there's another question you'd like me to answer at this point, I'd be happy to do so. Otherwise, I'll save
the
rest
of my time. There's an old saying here that my colleague is probably tired of me bringing up, that the late Spotswood Robinson said that those lights control the bar, only God controls this bench. And I do have a real question. You seemed to argue that there was not any failure of duty in not knowing that this was an ungrounded device. I didn't follow that exactly. Why was there not a... Assume for a moment. I understand you're saying there's no duty. But assume for a moment there is a duty. How could you possibly argue that it was not violated by bringing an ungrounded device onto the scene?
Your Honor, it's uncontradicted in this case that Mr. Korthal is the man who ordered this spider box, had ordered spider boxes many times before, and they've always had GFCI.
How did he know they did? If he doesn't check them...
That's not part of the evidence, Your Honor. That question wasn't asked, and it wasn't contradicted.
It wasn't certainly contested. Came to my mind. You said, well, they're always been grounded before. We didn't check it. They're always been grounded before. How long have you not been checking them? There might have been
it could have
70% of the prior ones that were not grounded either, and you wouldn't know it.
Your Honor, it could have been that he'd used many of the prior ones. He didn't use this one. We didn't have anybody that used it.
Wasn't it testimony that only six of, I don't know, 30 or something of these boxes that the supplier had the...
Yeah, but there's no testimony that he ever ordered from this company and not gotten GFCI.
Yeah. But he had ordered from this company.
He ordered from this company,
right, but
there's no evidence...
no testimony that he ever even checked any devices, was there?
There's no testimony one way.
How would he know that the prior devices did or did not have?
That's something that was not contested at the evidentiary stage by the Secretary. There's no contrary evidence anywhere in the record as to that.
It would have been a piece of cake to have checked the device to flip the lid. It would have been a piece of cake to have ordered and said we have to have the ground fault interruption devices on.
It's really
hard to see how you can... Yet far past a straight face test with an argument that they didn't violate duty if they had a duty.
Well, I don't think they had the duty, but if they did, what is that duty? I mean, does the duty have, whenever a general contractor orders any equipment or materials onto the job site, does he have a duty to inspect that equipment to make sure that it complies with all the applicable regulations, which is basically what's being held here? Because if it does, that leads to some absurd results. Every time a delivery truck comes on the site, then the general contractor has the duty to make sure that the backup alarm is working right, make sure that the materials on the back of the truck are properly strapped down so that
every time you get a spider box on the lot, it's not that hard to flip on the job site. It's not that hard to flip the cover.
It's true. That is true.
The statement of the rule seems pretty clear. The employer either knew or with the exercise of reasonable diligence could have known of the violative conditions.
That's true.
What Judge Santel is asking is, wouldn't it have been an exercise of reasonable diligence, namely flipping open the box, they could have known.
If there would have been any reason for him to suspect that this did not have GFCI, then maybe that would have been reasonable. But he did not, and that's uncontradicted.
So there's no reason to suspect that it did have it either. Well, he didn't know because he didn't flip the cover on where the ground fault detector would have been on the plug.
I understand that argument, but the evidence that's uncontradicted is that he did not. He did not suspect that there was any reason.
But his suspecting is irrelevant. This is a reasonable man rule, not what he himself did.
Well, a reasonable based on the circumstances in the case, and if most spider boxes that have come to the job site have always had GFCI.
Well, that's not.
You don't have any evidence.
You have no evidence of that, and the only evidence we have is, in fact, a minority of the boxes provided by the supplier even have it. So it would be surprising if the fact were that just randomly all the ones that had it arrived at the job site.
Then that in that case I would say then what we're really looking at is what is the duty? Does a general contractor have an unqualified duty to inspect all the materials and equipment that it orders to the job site?
No, Judge Garland read you the duty.
And I think it's not reasonable to expect that that whenever you order something like this is accommodation and where
when you say it's an accommodation, that's not what the contract says. The contract says all parties agree that the contractor may provide in locations determined to be appropriate for the project temporary electrical services, and further the subcontractor shall make use of the services as provided.
That's right. It says that the general contractor may provide.
That doesn't say as an accommodation or not. In this case, he did. And then the subcontractor is required to use what he provided.
I think that the subcontractor is required to use it, or it goes on, if he doesn't use it, he has to pay for the other source himself. But either way, the secretary has said that it's up to the employer whose employees are exposed to decide how best to protect himself under this standard, whether it's through a GFCI or an assured grounding program. It puts the burden directly on the employer whose employees are exposed. And in fact, in one of its interpretive letters, it says the word employer in this particular standard means only the employer.
Sorry, you're again getting into an argument you didn't make in your blue brief. We really can't address an argument you don't make.
Yes, Your Honor.
And as we'll give you back a couple minutes for rebuttal, but if you need it. But I also don't understand the argument that this is somehow in violation of 4B4.
Obviously, we don't do a very good job of explaining our argument there because none of the courts have considered it have gotten what we're trying to say.
Well, this is one more. I mean, I'm on the third of this court.
Let me try.
I don't understand your argument. I've been doing statutory and administrative law for 40 years.
The 4B4 says that nothing in the standards can increase an employer's liability at common law with regard to injuries to employees.
Right.
At common law, the rule is that a general contractor has no responsibility for subcontractors or the employees of a subcontractor.
And after the passage of this act, it would still be true that he had no liability at common law. He's got a responsibility under this statute.
He does, but
so far as a common law action, if such a subcontractor employee had an action before the enactment of the statute, he still does. If he didn't have an action at common law before the enactment of this statute or this regulation, he still doesn't.
I think that's right, but the practice.
Since that's right, I don't understand your argument.
Well, the practical effect of the MEP is to force the general contractor who normally had no duty to those employees to assume duties to those employees.
With respect to the responsibility under this, under the OSHA. But it's obvious that the OSHA creates new responsibilities with respect to OSHA. Whether or not this regulation is effective, there would be no reason for OSHA to exist if it didn't create new responsibilities. However, that section makes it plain that those new responsibilities do not extend to liability at common law. So I don't understand how this is any different than any other part of OSHA in that it creates new administrative responsibilities, but it doesn't affect common law liability.
Obviously, I guess that I just don't do a good job of explaining what we're saying.
No, it could be that you're just wrong.
It could be.
No, it's not at all obvious that you're not doing a good job of explaining. You could just be wrong, Judge.
It could be. I would say this, that the MEP requires a general contractor to conduct safety inspections of a subcontractor. Requires it. Says you must conduct safety inspections of your subcontractors. Mm-hmm. That makes the general contractor, that by itself, makes a general contractor liable for any injuries to a subcontractor employee. So it does not create
a common law liability. It makes them responsible for administrative remedies under OSHA. But I don't see how it affects common law liability.
Your Honor, we're just saying that as a practical effect, if you comply with the MEP, you necessarily increase your common law liability.
Let me see if I understand your argument is if OSHA is interpreting as requiring the contractor to do something. Some state court applying common law in the future might say, because the contractor had to do this, it now has a common law liability. Is that what you're saying?
Yes, Your Honor.
Well, I think the problem is not that we don't understand, but that we don't see that as the OSHA Act creating the liability, but rather that some state court in the future doing it. And maybe that would be inconsistent with the statute, or maybe it wouldn't, and maybe you would have a claim later against some state court that did that. But there's no contention, but that's not inconsistent with this court's view, that that's not the act itself, the OSHA Act creating a liability. That's somebody applying common law, either rightly or wrongly, sometime in the future.
Perhaps ignoring a statute to do so. Okay, and we have used more than your time, so if needed, we'll give back a couple of minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Hear from the respondent.
May it please the court, Gary Stearman on behalf of the Secretary of Labor. The court clearly understands the arguments that we've put forward today in our response briefs regarding the validity of the multi-employer citation policy. That's just a general statement of enforcement policy. Liability would still exist in this case and in other cases based on the principles that have been developed through the adjudicatory process and under the reasoning of the Martin versus Oshrick case. I'd like to bring up what I think is the final nail in the coffin, and that's the collateral estoppel argument.
Did you raise that argument below?
We did not raise the argument below, and there's a good reason for that, Your Honor. It might require a little bit of procedural recounting. This case, Summit 2, was fully briefed by July of 2007. Okay, the Eighth Circuit decision and let me back up again. This case and Summit 1 were both pending before the commission at the same time. This case was fully briefed in July of 2007. In February of 2009, the Eighth Circuit's decision comes down in Summit 1. That disposes.
What year is that? I'm sorry. What year?
February of 2009.
This case you said was briefed in July of 2007?
Yes, and it was sitting.
Oh, I see.
And it was pending before the commission. So, February 2009, the Eighth Circuit issues its opinion in Summit 1, and it resolves the 4B4 issue. Okay, remands the case to the commission for findings, factual findings based on its decision. In July of 2009, the commission issues its remand decision in Summit 1. The commission's decision on remand in Summit 1 disposes of the APA issue. So by the time of July 2009, both issues have been decided either by the Eighth Circuit or by the commission. Okay. At that time, this case had been fully briefed, but neither the 4B4 issue or the APA issue was briefed in this case, in Summit 2. The Summit, in its petition for discretionary review, which is a document that sets out a litany of ALJ errors, and asking the commission to take the case, raises the 4B4 and APA issues. The commission directs review on the Darden and creating employer issues and tells the parties you're free to brief any of the issues you've raised in the PDRs, petition for discretionary reviews. Summit doesn't brief the 4B4 or the APA issues. So neither were really a part of the Summit 2 when it was pending before the commission. So these other decisions in Summit 1 come out. We have no notice. We have no idea that these two issues are a part of this case. So there was no reason for us to raise it.
So let me see if I understand. You're saying that of the three issues that have been raised before this court, two of them were never raised before the agency?
Two of them were not briefed before the commission in the merits briefs. Now, it raised them. Summit raised them in its petition for discretionary review, and we have a complicated waiver issue. But we didn't brief that because we thought the collateral estoppel argument was much stronger. And that is,
I just want to be clear that they petitioned based on them, but when it came time to actually brief before the commission, they didn't raise those two issues?
It did not raise them, and you can check.
Why is that complicated? That seems like an obvious waiver. It seems a lot less complicated than the law of collateral estoppel.
Because the commission decided the issues.
They decided both of those issues.
In Summit 2.
Yes, they decided both the 4B4 and the APA issues.
Yeah, so the commission reached the issues.
So they were well aware that those were two issues before them, right?
The commission was.
And what year was that?
What year did the commission decide this
Summit
case?
Summit 2, yeah. And what month and what year?
Okay, this decision came down in August 2010.
Okay, so just to be clear, I'm still having difficulty seeing why this is complicated.
I thought it was complicated.
In August of 2010, the commission decided the 4B4 and APA issues, correct?
Correct.
And in July of 2009, the commission decided those same issues on some of those issues on remand. And in February of 2009, the Eighth Circuit decided some of those issues on remand, correct?
Correct.
So why is any of this complicated history prevent that commission in August of 2010 from saying collateral estoppel?
Well, I think the commission certainly could have.
What's the explanation for why they didn't? If the commission believes that collateral estoppel applies here, they could have thought about it, the Summit 1 one for an entire year, and the Eighth Circuit Summit 1 decision for 18 months.
Well, that's correct, Your Honor, but I think Summit's argument is that the Secretary waived the collateral estoppel defense by not filing some sort of supplemental brief before the commission and raising the defense. And our response to that, and they make that in a reply brief, so this is our first chance to address it. Our response to that is this response brief was our first logical opportunity to raise collateral estoppel.
Why couldn't it have been raised before the August 2010 decision?
Because we didn't know it was a part of Summit 2, because on the merits, these issues were not briefed.
And in fairness to petitioner, they had no, you say they didn't raise until their reply, but they had no reason to address this issue until reply.
That's correct, Your Honor, but I just want to make sure there's not another waiver argument coming our way.
Is there a Chenery argument?
Yeah.
Normally we're bound by what the reasoning given by the commission. The commission didn't give the collateral estoppel reasoning.
I think there's an exception here since the commission, since we weren't able to make the defense in the first place. I believe that the Chenery decision really goes to policymaking bodies, and under the OSHRC, Martin versus OSHRC decision, it's the secretary that's the policymaker here.
Okay.
If the court has any other questions.
I started to say esoterically, I guess, that it actually has to be the decision-making body for Chenery to apply rather than policymaking. If we're reviewing the decision of an administrative agency, whether they are the ultimate policymaker or not, so wouldn't Chenery apply to any administrative decision we're reviewing?
It's my understanding of Chenery, and it wasn't briefed here, Your Honors,
okay.
Is that it's the decision maker, but the underlying rationale is that the courts are not to interfere with the policy making mm-hmm. of the decision makers. And so if you just have a...
Whether the decision maker is the ultimate policy maker or not, it's still beyond the compass of the court, isn't it? As you say, it's not briefed here, so perhaps.
Yeah, I'm sorry, Your Honor.
I'll let you off on that one. Then.
Unless the court has questions for me,
I confessed it was esoteric when I started that line, so the court has no further questions, I think. Thank you, counsel.
Okay, thank you.
I give the petitioner 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Your Honor, if the court has questions, otherwise I have nothing prepared.
Thank you.
No. Okay, seeing none, give us recess.